Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Joel and Tony, and we've got a couple of sci-fi things to discuss today. We're discussing a new book called Artemis by Andy Weir, and we're also discussing the movie Blade Runner 2049, which was just in theaters. It may still be, but I'm sure the original Blade Runner will sneak into that a little bit as well, too. All right, so Artemis is a new science fiction book by Andy Weir, author of The Martian, and it takes place on the moon this time in a lunar city and follows another lovably frank protagonist, I would say. So, guys, what'd you think of Artemis?
I really liked it. There was a good pacing to it, one that kind of started you right in the heat of the action and kept you within it. And like you said, a frank protagonist that kind of was personal and willing to share and overshare and be goofy. And it made what might be kind of like a stark life as a porter or a smuggler on the moon into like actually pretty interesting and funny. I didn't read The Martian, but I know that everybody loved the fact that The Martian had an awesome, you know, protagonist that was really, and that's one of the things I thought this book also excelled at. I don't think it necessarily did the best job of creating characters in the rest of the world. Like, I thought they weren't like super fleshed out, but the story moved along really nicely and it was really well paced. And I thought like the world was just, like the idea of the colony was really well executed too. Yeah. And it felt like, you know, they didn't leave the moon pretty much at all the entire book. There was letters from someone on Earth, but it created a reality that I wouldn't know what a lunar colony would be like, but this is like a really well-painted picture of that. And
he bridged it into reality pretty well, into our time, even though it's set into the future. He made it believable that it would grow to be that type of a lunar colony in the future. And he really, really likes to write about science. It's almost like a Neil deGrasse Tyson kind of bringing science down to the every person. But I think that the dialogue and the interaction with people was a little bit, it could have used more. I felt that his dialogue was kind of cardboard, but the science part was, you really just saw it jump off the page at those parts.
Like inserted wherever he could into, you know, I have to pick up this, you know, very heavy package, but, you know, don't forget the gravity on the moon means I can lift something that, you know, weighs this much, whereas on Earth you wouldn't be able to do that. Talking about the cooling systems of the robots on the moon and how you cool an engine with no air. So I've read a lot of Heinlein, and it reminds me of like half Have Spacesuit Will Travel and half The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, but funny is how I would describe this book. If you like those old sci-fi books, it sticks with that, but it's modern, it's funny, you know, it's sarcastic, as we all are in this modern age, it seems. It's not, though, I will agree, it's not like the deepest story and the strongest of themes, but it's only 300 pages, and it's a really fast read, so I appreciate that about it.
It's a great romp.
Yeah.
Or, you know, EVA, as they would term it in the on the moon. But even the action sequences, which there are a lot of, those are, as Tony said, fast paced, and but even those are treated like a science equation. You know, as you said, you know, there's this amount, so I did this, and there's this amount of, you know, and that was a really interesting blend of the two to create, I think, an original voice for that. So very much like what he did in The Martian, and I enjoyed The Martian a lot, and it occurred to me that there's a lot less characters in The Martian. There's him and the environment around him, and in this one there's a lot more personal interaction. So that's where The Martian excelled, and Artemis could have used a little bit more work.
I liked there was much talk about the sense of dread of being on the moon that I would have, that she would kind of explain away with, like, these walls are impenetrable. Like, what is anyone worried about? I'm like, but yeah, but you're on the moon and there's no air out there. And so there's a lot of addressing those concerns about, this is why it's safe. This is how we plan. This is how we plan for fires. This is how we plan for air breaches. This is how we plan for everything. And, like, again, that science that he loves to talk about like, would come into play. And I'm like, oh, this is fascinating. I never thought of a fire crew on the moon isn't going to have water hoses because it'll burn up all the oxygen in a room and then it goes out, right? And so long as you don't put more oxygen in the room, you'll be okay. I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. So what do you do? How do you get people out of that room without letting oxygen in? And so, like, that's where the book is great, is things like that. I didn't mention a character's name or a plot point at all in what I just said, but that passage was gripping, right? because there's lives on the line and it's totally unfamiliar territory.
Yeah, it's like testing out these hypotheticals. And I even like the details of like, well, what do you eat? And it's like this like reprocessed algae. They call it like
gunk,
yeah. And yeah, it's like things like that where or looking out and seeing tourists being in awe of the waste of the surface of the moon. She's just like, well, it's just dirt and rocks. Like, this is boring. And I think like it's cool because it gives you perspective of like someone that really understands it, because Jazz is such a scientist and an engineer and a knowledgeable person. Her perspective is totally unromanticized about any of this stuff, you know? So it's kind of cool having that as the protagonist and then the tourists to contrast that.
The tourist contrasts that, and then the reader is the one who has all these romantic notions of what love must be like on the moon. And then it turns out, oh, it's just like this, and that's how it is. Like, it's better or it's worse, or it's good or it's bad. Like, she knows how it is on the moon because she's been there since she was six, I think. So it's mundane, to tell you the truth, on the moon, it turns out.
But it's all at 1/6 gravity, too.
Yeah.
So everything you do, everything that happens.
Yeah. So they're talking about, like, stairs at different heights and in different modules and things like that. And
again, the action sequences are pretty
unique
as well.
Yeah. And the threat of, you know, as a, you don't get, there's no space to hold the criminals, right, on the moon. So it's like you get sent back to your home country and they'll sentence you there.
Yeah.
And how terrible it would be to go back to full gravity after having lived in 1/6 gravity is like the ultimate punishment. I like that kind of added aspect of, oh gosh, not Earth, you know.
Right. Yeah, to go back there. Steroids and rehab.
A month in rehab or something. Yeah.
You know, there was a great similarity when I was reading it between this and Michael Crichton's novel, The Sphere, where you had danger in confined spaces that you can't leave. And also, like, the technical aspect details combined with the natural details around in science. So I thought that was quite reminiscent. That would be, in my head, a decent read-alike. So if you enjoyed Michael Crichton's technical know-how, it's Andy Weir is the same way, only with science instead of technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the major appeal of the book is these nuggets, these ideas that come like kind of rapid fire, like almost every 3 or 5 pages, there's a new
revelation.
Revelation you have to make. Exactly right, about how life is for them and how it's different from either how I live or how I would expect them to live on the moon.
But at the same time, she's going through situations that we all possibly could encounter.
Sure.
And just in a much different way of doing things.
Yeah, it's still a drama, I assure you. But it's the science that really got me excited for this book. So I would say if you liked The Martian, I would recommend this book. If you didn't like The Martian, I would still recommend this book. Because I think it's if you like science, I absolutely recommend this book. It's not the best book I ever read. That's okay. It's a good B+, something like that. I would definitely recommend it to anyone who is on the fence about it. But if sci-fi and the moon is not for you, then maybe let it be. A great second work from Andy Weir. I'm real excited that it could have gone bad for him because, you know, there's talks of sophomore slumps and things like that. But this was fantastic, I think. So that is Artemis. It releases November 17th, I believe. We've ordered plenty of copies for the library, so place your holds and, you know, get them from the quick picks and all that good stuff. So next, we're going to talk about Blade Runner 2049. This is a sequel to Blade Runner, and my goodness, is it ever a sequel, I would say. If you haven't seen the first Blade Runner, I would absolutely recommend that you watch it before you watch this Blade Runner, because it picks up kind of right where the first one left off, except for a gap of 20 or 30 years, something like that. But guys, what did you think of Blade Runner 2049?
It's speechless.
Yeah?
It really, that's why I'm having a little trouble coming up with a word for it. It was just, especially after the Blade Runner, the first one, you're just left with this melancholy yet hopeful yet just you don't know which end is up. And that kind of thing. And then Blade Runner 2049 comes along and it illuminates and yet really just it's very introspective and a vast outreaching film at the same time. And this is what made me excited about it was that it really followed Blade Runner, the original, with these vast shots of these big buildings and really kind of accentuated the depth of, you know, where can humanity go but up, essentially. And if we're going to have to account for more people, we're going to have to build up. But then there's also that desolation, right, of the original Blade Runner, of a world gone wrong, and there's like more room now than there are people. You got a sense of that for Blade Runner 2049, even with the opening scenes of the farms, and you know, you just got this sense of vastness, and I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, it opened with that long, slow flyover of the solar arrays, right, before it made it to the protein farm.
Right.
Yeah, this movie is gorgeous, to say the least. The color scheme kind of like slowly shifts every half hour from, you know, blues to yellows to grays to whatever. And that's kind of a joy to watch. The shots are long and slow. They give you time to take in the detail and to feel the weight of what they're putting on the screen. Like the weight of these towers, you can feel it as they loom in the smog. It's got a detective story, which is great, just like the first one. So you're always kind of in the dark in this movie. You're never really sure what to believe about the case that's being researched. And then it's also Blade Runner. So it's about the nature of reality, and it's about what is and is not a person and what is and is not true. And so it's like you're kind of in the dark about everything in this movie.
And in that regard, I mean, it is a continuation. It is a sequel. I would say even more so than, you know, Episode 7 is like a rebooted Star Wars to Episode 6, because this movie has a smaller sort of in a way. It has just the first original movie. I mean, there were director cuts and final cuts of the original movie. So there's the original Blade Runner has so many different interpretations. But this movie, we could say, doesn't matter which, I think, interpretation you have. The ambiguity, it's okay if that kind of persists.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, it like builds on the motifs of the original so well. And it takes so many of those like touchstones. Like you were just saying, it's a detective story. You know, obviously Deckard is back in this one, but his character is so core to the idea of that, of who's perceiving and how are we perceiving this reality, because he, and in addition to him, but you see it so much in the agent, the Blade Runner, Kay. You see more, I think, of the shift going on internally in Kay in this movie than I think you even saw in the original Blade Runner. I think in Blade Runner, it would kind of allow all of it happened precipitously at the end, maybe. But in 2049, I mean, you just get a really interesting portrait of that same change almost happening within this person.
It's more gradual.
And it's more gradual.
In the original one, it seemed kind of like backlogged. Or, you know, kind of like back-ended towards the end of the film, whereas Gosling's character was just over time, you could see how it was affecting him.
Yeah, like scene by scene, he gets more emotional maybe, or more consumed or more obsessive, maybe all those things.
He's still acting the same way he did when they established him as a character, but you're starting to see little tells into what's going on, and I thought that was great.
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with Blade Runner, the original or the new movie, it's basically about these clones, right? People that are made, not born, and the dissection of whether or not should they be treated like people? Can they be slaves, slave labor? Is that unethical? Is it not? Like, where do rights begin and end? But then furthermore, these clones, to make them act human, are given many human characteristics, like memories that they never had, memories of being a child, that they never were a child. They were grown as an adult, but they have these memories. And the question is, are these memories real? Are these memories not? And does that make them people? Does that make them not? And that was very much the themes of the first one in terms of like rebellions among them. And the Blade Runner, who is Harrison Ford in the first movie and Ryan Gosling in this movie, is charged with hunting down and retiring or killing clones gone bad, if not just all clones. It gets kind of funny in the new movie. The new ones are okay, so they want to root out the old ones. And then Ryan Gosling himself is a clone, a replicant himself. So he's also dealing with racism. People who don't trust him. Obviously, the people he's hunting don't trust him, but then, like, his neighbors don't trust him, right? Because.
Or his employers
don't trust him, right?
And the people he works with,
yeah.
His colleagues don't trust him. And that was
calling him names in the hallway. Yeah.
His baseline and tests.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And his reaction to it was just amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of the effects of the original, they're alive and well in the new one. I didn't look into how they made these scenes. I don't know if it was more CG, less CG. I'm not sure. I didn't study that, but it looks the same. The cities are still huge and oppressive. It is still
plus 30 years.
So there's like all the smog, all the dirt, all the buildings, all the tech, all the neon, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fascinating that they continued the progression of the original universe from Blade Runner. Instead of Blade Runner and then included stuff from our pop culture in between, it was still from Blade Runner. Like, yeah. I saw, there was an ad for Atari. I noticed CCCP on one of the – so it was as if the Soviet Union never fell.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that. I thought it was – they were just being true, very true to that universe.
Yeah, the writers and the directors must have written a Bible about, you know, thou shalt not infringe on the original Blade Runner. These things exist. These things do not.
And put in as many Sony references,
of course,
as possible. I saw
a little product placement there. Right. They made the movie, so they had a couple of the big ads were Sony ads. I thought the acting throughout this movie was phenomenal, even like great and small. I loved David Bautista, who was the farmer at the very beginning. I mean, I love this guy because I love Guardians, and he is a hilarious oaf in Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2. But in this one, he delivers a line that sticks with you for the whole movie. And it's amazing to me that he's come that far. Edward James almost skips in for a scene. And, you know, you're on the edge of your seat because he makes you wait for every word that he says. Jared Leto was terrifying, I think.
Yeah.
He's a man that speaks only in riddles. And it's not made clear, like, what he really does. You know he's in charge, but is he brilliant? Is he cunning? Is he ruthless? Is he all these things? Like, he doesn't really...
Is he in his right mind?
Yeah.
He's like psychotic. I mean, it's... You just never knew what was going to come out of him.
Right. And so, like, you get to understand... Wallace is his name. You get to understand his motives by watching his subordinates and their actions betray what his motives are. And that's very interesting to me. He just kind of, you know, sets things in motion and then just lets them happen, I suppose, as a good manager may do, instead of micromanaging himself. But just like, you know, there will be silence and no reaction from him, but, you know, they carry out acts that are hideous sometimes. And you have to remind yourself that this is Wallace at work.
Right. His alien, very alien, like pupil dilation that they did with contacts and I'm sure effects in some way. But he's integrating with computers too at this point where like it's like he's a programmer running a program with these
with these
things. And to me, it's like he's becoming more of the thing that he's like subordinating more and more.
Yeah.
So it's like this question of, I think goes back to what Joel started with like, is he trying to make a better humanity or is he corrupting the image of like what humans are capable of by like doing terrible things, right? Like, His vision has kind of driven him to that point, to that madness. So,
well, and there's a theme of, and it's right from Philip K. Dick, who you know wrote the novel that this is all based on.
Right.
But it's the question of Philip K. Dick asking, "Who is God?" And related, are we God? Can we be God? More importantly, and that's what I think the fascination of can we make humans. Like ourselves and how realistic can we make them, and you can even go and implant memories and so forth and even go beyond further than that. And that's just the huge theme of like you were saying, you know, Wallace wants to go take it to another dimension.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a line where he's like, I've already made life on 9 worlds possible through the expansion of the replicants, but he's like, but I still haven't done anything because I haven't figured out. And then there's like the whole plot of the movie is him trying to figure out how life was made. You know, through replicants and all that. So, but I, one of the other parallels I just noticed, because you brought up the line that the protein farmer said in the start, is there was the really poetic and most kind of the crux of Blade Runner was the speech by the replicant at the end there too, where he was kind of grasping on for his life because they were programmed to live 4 years. Those like the models and that. So he died of old age, but he was like, he had a moment that he was able to impress his humanity basically on Deckard in that last moment.
I've seen things you wouldn't believe. All these moments lost in time. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Doesn't matter where memories come from. Doesn't matter that you have them. You know, those are, these are just...
Those are the questions that Kay struggles with, right?
Exactly. They're the brain twisters that you came out from Blade Runner, and they and 2049 just gives you a whole bunch of new ones.
Yeah. Keeps it going. It is every bit a sequel, and it is fantastic in this age of reboots and remakes and startovers and sequels nobody wanted. This is a sequel that I did not want until I saw it. And I said, no, this is phenomenal. This is great. This is what sequels should be. Is
to carry on the story.
Carry on the story. It didn't retell it. It didn't rehash those themes. Those themes in Blade Runner still exist, and you can go watch the first one if you want to grapple with those themes. If you want to grapple with these themes now, come to 2049 and have a whole new set of moral quandaries laid on you.
Yeah. I thought there was a little bit, going back to the book, with the replication of, I think they felt, in the book, there was a war called World War Terminus that ended everything, and they were going for it wiped out animal life. And so animal life is almost sacred, where everyone has to own a pet. And if you can't afford a real pet, you have to have an electric pet. And there again, can we make pets as lifelike? Can we make animals lifelike as possible?
Sure.
And then there was an echo of that in Blade Runner with Edward James Olmos's character doing the origami, which I thought was fantastic. It was just kind of like taking that theme from the book, because the book was, it was somewhat dated, and they updated it, and they kept some of the things, and they kind of echoed. And there is a bit of that in the new movie, too, and I was really happy to see that there was almost like a stamp of authenticity. So with Harrison Ford's character, there was some of the animal theme that went through with that.
That's
so
true,
So that's Blade Runner 2049. It sounds like we were all awestruck by it and maybe even overwhelmed by it.
There's a lot of, if you like it, there's a lot of the movie to like.
Yes.
It's 2 hours and
44 minutes.
44 minutes long. So
I dreaded that going in. I was like, I don't know if I stay awake for this entire movie. But then,
In the theater, I saw it and just had the volume turned way up, and it was just like a musical, sonic, visual experience. Like
I'm delighted that I saw it in the theater because there's some crushing audio in that movie that really should be experienced in the theater.
It really kind of, it was mood enhancement, really, the music. It was just sonic mood adjustment. It was really crazy.
So if you haven't seen it yet, go see Blade Runner 2049. If you're interested in other things Blade Runner, we've got the original at the library. You can check that out, or you can check out Philip K. Dick, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And okay, so that'll do it for the Pint and Click podcast. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time.